This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. President Donald Trump has provoked the ire of the international community with his fiery speech on Tuesday at the United Nations General Assembly, where he threatened to, quote, totally destroy North Korea. He started out on Monday morning with an innocuous speech while seated next to UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, where he praised the UN and then complained about its bureaucracy.
We affirm our commitment to the United Nations reform. And reform is what we're talking about. I applaud the Secretary General for laying out a vision to reform the United Nations so that it better serves the people we all represent. We support your efforts to look across the entire system and to find ways the United Nations can better and be better at development, management, peace, and security. The United Nations was founded on truly noble goals. These include affirming the dignity and worth of the human person and striving for international peace. The United Nations has helped advance toward these goals in so many ways: feeding the hungry, providing disaster relief, and empowering women and girls in many societies all across the world. Yet in recent years, the United Nations has not reached its full potential because of bureaucracy and mismanagement. While the United Nations on a regular budget has increased by 140% and its staff has more than doubled since 2000, we are not seeing the results in line with this investment. But I know that under the Secretary General, that's changing, and it's changing fast, and we've seen it.
That was Donald Trump speaking at the United Nations on Monday. A day later, he set a completely different tone when he gave his formal address to the General Assembly, referring to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un as Rocket Man. Here's some of what Trump had to say.
No one has shown more contempt for other nations and for the well-being of their own people than the depraved regime in North Korea. It is responsible for the starvation deaths of millions of North Koreans and for the imprisonment, torture, killing, and oppression of countless more. We were all witness to the regime's deadly abuse when an innocent American college student, Otto Warmbier, was returned to America only to die a few days later. We saw it in the assassination of the dictator's brother using banned nerve agents in an international airport. We know it kidnapped a sweet 13-year-old Japanese girl from a beach in her own country to enslave her as a language tutor for North Korea's spies. If this is not twisted enough, now North Korea's reckless pursuit of nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles threatens the entire world with unthinkable loss of human life. It is an outrage that some nations would not only trade with such a regime, but would arm, supply, and financially support a country that imperils the world with nuclear conflict. No nation on earth has an interest in seeing this band of criminals arm itself with nuclear weapons and missiles. The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary. That's what the United Nations is all about. That's what the United Nations is for. Let's see how they do. It is time for North Korea to realize that the denuclearization is its only acceptable future.
That's Donald Trump on Tuesday addressing the United Nations General Assembly, threatening to, quote, totally destroy North Korea. For analysis, we turn now to Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of a number of books, including Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror and Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan. She's also written quite a lot about the United Nations. Welcome back to the show, Phyllis.
Good to be with you, Sonali.
So how unprecedented is it for a U.S. leader to speak the way Trump did at the U.N. General Assembly? And how unprecedented is it for any head of state to threaten to destroy another state?
It's pretty unprecedented. I don't know of any other, certainly no U.S. president, not George Bush when he came to the U.N. to justify his illegal war in Iraq. And made the false claim that he was just trying to attack the regime and not trying to attack the country as a whole. But he made the effort to make it sound like it was a much narrower focused situation. In this case, to use that kind of language, we will totally destroy North Korea. That's calling for genocide against 25 million people. It's staggering. It has never happened before. I don't think any other head of state would ever even consider using language like this, let alone coming from the head of state of the one country that has actually used nuclear weapons, that has the nuclear capacity to destroy the peoples of the entire world over and over and over again in its arsenal today, to use this kind of language saying that if there's the continuing threat, not even if a nuclear weapon is used, but if there's a continuing threat, we would destroy a country. This is absolutely unprecedented. I was stunned, I must say, to see that during the speech, there was actually a small smattering of applause at a couple of points, not certainly with anything he said about North Korea, but I was stunned that anyone sitting in that hall, it was perhaps not surprising that the Israeli delegation led by Bibi Netanyahu, but I was surprised that almost anyone else would actually applaud for that. For a person making such a call, but nonetheless, they did. This was an astonishing speech. There's never been a speech like this at the General Assembly. This was, you know, a speech where Trump talked about wanting harmony and friendship, but clearly harmony and friendship on U.S. terms. When he talked about the new definition of his constant repeated goal of America first, by saying, of course we want America first. You all should want the first for your country. What he was really saying was, you all should want America first, because that was the exclusion. We want every country to be strong, independent, and sovereign as long as they toe our line. As soon as they step out of line, then sovereignty is not on the table. Then international law is not on the table. Then on the whole question of protecting a population is not on the table. So this was a rather extraordinary speech of justifying U.S. power in the world in an absolutist kind of way. And he has his now new triplet of evil, like Bush's evil empire, only for Trump now, it seems to be North Korea, Iran, and Venezuela. Against whom he raised significant new threats,
right,
that he has not raised earlier.
So Trump has used very harsh language and extreme language on North Korea before, fire and fury and all of that. This certainly seemed to blow that out of the water. I mean, even the way in which he referred to the North Korean leader, Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself. I mean, just, you know, at the United Nations General Assembly to use this language. He then reiterated everything on his Twitter feed by posting a video of himself and repeating this language if we are forced to destroy itself, the U.S. will have no choice but to totally destroy hashtag NOCO. So this was clearly not something spur of the moment. This was clearly something that was scripted. But the day before, Phyllis, the day before, he struck a very different tone where he talked about the great founding of the United Nations, the great principles on which the U.N. was founded. He complained a little bit about the U.N. Fees going up and too much bureaucracy, but by and large, he was pretty tame just the day before.
That's right. The day before, he was relatively tame, although in another meeting on the day before, also on Monday, He also led with a group of Latin American presidents where he also escalated his rhetoric against Venezuela in a similar way. But his speech at the broader UN meeting on Monday was indeed far more typical, let's say, of world leaders addressing the United Nations. It was more anodyne. It was supportive in general of the United Nations, although he had one point that was so completely wrong, both on the Monday and Tuesday speeches, that it was rather astonishing when he talked about the United States having to pay a disproportionate amount of the funding, both the military and economic support for the United Nations. First of all, on the military side, the U.S. does not provide peacekeeping troops. It has a total of less than 80 peacekeeping troops in all of the thousands of peacekeeping operation troops that are serving in the United Nations positions around the world. Less than 80 of them are from the United States at all. But it is true that the U.S. pays the highest amount of dues to the United Nations, but it is absolutely not disproportionate. It is precisely proportionate because it's calculated at the basis of paying the same percentage of the UN's funds, the UN dues, as is represented by your share of the global economy. The U.S. is by far the wealthiest country in terms of the size of the economy, so it's absolutely proportionate that it pay that amount of dues. It's not disproportionate at all. He's simply making that up to claim that somehow the United States is being shafted. The great deal maker thinks that he's getting a bad deal and therefore we should change it. Similar to the language that he used about the Iran deal, which he said was the worst deal ever made in US history, and one that, as he put it, is not over yet, implying, we don't know, implying that he would leave the deal, which seems not to be top of their agenda right now, implying that he would try to renegotiate a better deal, something that he's spoken of early in the campaign, but which other signers, both Iran and the other U.S. allies and other powerful countries that have signed onto that deal, have made clear this is not going to happen. This is the deal. Right. The U.S. can walk away from it, but they cannot renegotiate a better deal or a new deal. That's just not in the cards.
What about reaffirming his relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu? The U.S. and Israel, of course, have long been allies at the United Nations. Often the U.S. is the sole ally Israel has on many resolutions over the years. I suppose on that front, Trump did not make waves, right?
Well, this was a traditional position of the U.S. to reaffirm the uncritical solidarity with the nation of Israel, with the people of Israel, with the prime minister of Israel, et cetera, et cetera. It was actually interesting, and I was a bit relieved, if that word could even be applied to this rather horrifying speech, that he did not announce some kind of a new peace process or a new campaign on Israel-Palestine, because that at this stage would probably make everything worse. But the camera panning to Netanyahu sitting in the audience during that speech showed him applauding with more vigor than anyone else, as far as I could tell, in the entire hall for Trump's speech. But that part was not different than traditional U.S. positions in maintaining that relationship with Israel.
Phyllis, on this issue of North Korea and even Venezuela, which you mentioned, is this just bluster from Trump? I mean, it's hard to sort of figure this man out. He likes to make threats. He likes to be the guy in charge. He likes to be the boss. He likes to be looked up to and lauded. But on a world stage, when you make threats like this, at some point, yeah, somebody might call your bluff, and then your only choice is to escalate. And that's really scary.
It's very scary. It is very scary. We don't know exactly what the intentions are, but we have to keep in mind a few things. One is certainly the possibility that you raise, Sonali, that when you make threats like this, someone else may call your bluff and you might think you then have no option but to make good on that threat. In fact, you always have that option. You always have the option of walking back threats. So let's not fall into the trap of assuming there is no other option. Now, for someone like Donald Trump, that's probably not a viable action. That's probably not a viable possibility that he would walk back that kind of an effort by some other country to call his bluff. On the other hand, we should keep in mind that it is a crime. It is a crime in international law. It's a violation of the UN Charter of this organization that the President of the United States just called beautiful. He then completely violated the Charter by making threats. The threats are themselves illegal. It is illegal to, it's a crime against international law to threaten another country. And a threat like this from a country capable of totally annihilating a country, not simply attacking it, not simply regime change, but we will totally destroy North Korea. He did not say, we will totally destroy Rocket Man. We will totally destroy the North Korean president. He said, we will totally destroy North Korea. That kind of a threat is a direct violation of international law. And if the...
So making that threat, he has violated international law. That's a really important point, huh?
It's a very important point. It's a violation of international law to threaten. It's part of the founding principles of the United Nations that member states do not have the right to threaten each other or to go to war against each other. Either is a violation.
So it's very likely either Trump knows that and deliberately is flouting it, or is simply ignorant of that because he has zero experience in politics. Either scenario is quite discomforting. Now, Phyllis, all of this comes at the same time that the U.S. Senate, and this isn't getting much attention, the U.S. Senate just voted to approve a huge increase in U.S. military spending. Trump himself had asked for something like $40 to $50 billion of an increase in defense spending. And the Senate approved $80 billion of increased spending. This, of course, at a time when we're constantly being told there isn't enough money for public education or healthcare.
Yes, this is a huge issue. And Trump, in fact, on his Tuesday speech at the General Assembly, he referred to it bragging, as if he expected people in that hall, members of other countries who are in the crosshairs of U.S. weapons, that they would be happy that the U.S. is now passing an almost $700 billion military budget.
Wow.
That was an astonishing moment in his speech. It was based on the idea that you should all love this. Why? Why would anyone else sleep better when the U.S. is spending more money on weapons, more money on nukes, more money on troops, less money on education, less money on healthcare, less money on jobs, less money on infrastructure, less money on diplomacy? The $54 billion increase that Trump asked for, $54 billion, was taken out of a 29% cut in the State Department budget. Almost a third of the entire diplomatic budget of the United States was stripped away to go to the military. More than a third of the EPA, of the Environmental Protection Agency budget, was stripped away to go to the military. Extraordinary cuts in the things that actually keep Americans safer, things that keep our water safe, things that allow diplomats to do their job so that we don't have to go to war. These are the things that Trump's proposal called for massive cuts.
And then the Senate went overboard.
Got a hold of it, they almost doubled it.
Yeah.
It's a shocking day.
And this, Phyllis, it was an 89 senators voted for this increase, for this particular version of the defense spending bill. That means that a good number of Democrats joined Republicans in doing this.
And this is one of the bills that every year is known to be necessary to pass. They have to pass this in their understanding of how the world works. And one of the effects of that is that you have a scenario where members of Congress who may be actually quite opposed, whether in the House or the Senate, they may be actually quite opposed to the wars that the U.S. is actually fighting at the moment, the Trump wars. But because weapons systems are designed so that they are produced in every congressional district in the country, nobody wants to vote against it because somebody is going to come back in the next election and say, you shouldn't vote for this guy. He voted against the 2,000 jobs at the X corporation that's making some little gizmo that goes into an F-35 fighter bomber. That's the brilliant conspiracy, conscious or not, and I don't usually believe in conspiracies, but it's the one I can't imagine doesn't exist within the military producers, the military industrial complex. When they started their work in the post-World War II era, One of the things they did that was so brilliant was to spread out production so that there is not a member of Congress who doesn't have jobs in her district or in his district or in that state, if it's a member of the Senate, that depends on military spending, whether it's 12 or 15 jobs in a little factory somewhere or 25,000 jobs at Boeing, whatever it is. They are accountable to those jobs, and that makes them accountable to these wars. So they vote for it over and over and over again.
Well, Phyllis, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll certainly see what happens with the UN speech or after the UN speech that Trump gave. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you, Sonali. It's been a pleasure.
My guest is Phyllis Bennis, the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's written extensively about the United Nations. Her books also include Understanding ISIS and The New Global War on Terror, as well as Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan. We've been discussing Trump's speech to the UN General Assembly on Tuesday. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.